Welcome to episode 156 of Junk Filter. My name is Jesse Hawken, and my returning guest is the playwright and writer Ashley Naftool, whose work has appeared at Bright Wall, Dark Room, and the Phoenix New Times. Friend of the show, joining me once again from the great state of Arizona. Ashley, welcome back to Junk Filter.
Thanks for having me back. A pleasure to be here.
Our subject for today is the Czechoslovak New Wave of the 1960s, and one of the lesser-known but key figures of the movement, the director Wolček Žázny, who directed a favorite film of ours, recently rediscovered and now available to watch as part of Criterion Channel's Cat Movies collection, 1963's The Cassandra Cat. We're also going to talk about a couple of Žázny's films, the Czechoslovak New Wave in general, and some of our favorite cat movies. Ashley, this was a film I found out about from you on your first appearance on one of our very first episodes.
Well, first of all, I just want to say I'm very proud that you found out that way. Like, if I've done anything right, it's spreading the word about this movie. Yeah, during the pandemic, there's this pirate radio station, Cinephobe, that used to play like 24 hours of just stuff that films are hard to find. They're either out of print or just not commercially available. And they play a lot of like, Czech films, Polish films, like Jerzy Skolimensky. And one of the days, I saw on their TV, and like, they had like, this kind of scrolling TV guide. And one of the films on there was The Cassandra Cat, which I had not heard of at all. But I looked up on Letterboxd what it was about, and the synopsis was a magical cat with sunglasses. I'm like, okay, it's sold. I don't need anything else. I will check this out. And I know Jonathan Rosenbaum described the film as a cross between The Pied Piper and Bye Bye Birdie, which I think kind of nailed the vibe. Like, I watched that film, and I'm like, holy shit. Like, it's not a musical, but has all that like transportive qualities of like, you know, it was an incredible film. Like it was a film so good that I emailed the people behind Cinephobe. They had like an anonymous email and say, hey, can you guys please play that again? Like, I want to see that again. Like it was this wonderful film. And it really like, out of all the things I saw during the pandemic, like that film was the one that I think sunk its hooks deepest into my subconscious.
One of the reviews that I read of The Cassandra Cat on Letterboxd was a 3-word review. It said, cats are anarchists. And I think that's the energy that I get the most from cats when they show up in films, especially when filmmakers capture their true natures, which are, you know, they're cuddly and cute, but they're also determined to destroy your life however they can.
Yeah, they're enigmatic and they're passive, which is what makes them so interesting. Like, you want to know what their deal is. Or for dogs is always just going to be like, hey, what's up, buddy? Let's hang out.
The line that I heard was that dogs come when you call them, but cats take a message and get back to you later.
That's perfect.
How familiar are you with the films from Czechoslovakia in the 60s, Ashley?
I mean, I'm definitely still a novice in it, but I mean, I've seen a few. Like, before I saw The Cassandra Cat, I had seen Daisies and Valerie and a Week of Wonders because, you know, they're Criterion films, and that's kind of my entry point. But after I saw Cassandra Cat, I started seeing some other stuff like Case for Rookie Hangman, The Port and the Party and the Guests. And the thing is, with all those Czech films, like, they all share a certain, like, surreality to them, but they all approach the material in very different ways. Like I've seen no two Czech films that are the same. Like they're all very, very different from each other. In a way where the French New Wave, even though although it turns out their own unique spins, like you can kind of do like a triple feature of like New Wave films and you kind of feel cohesive of a whole. Where I don't think Czech New Wave you get that. Like they're all very different from each other, very anarchic and you know, kind of all chasing their own muses in different directions.
I think that this movement was a significant contributor to all of the changes in world cinema that manifested themselves in the late 60s. Like one thing about a lot of the Czechoslovak New Wave movies is that they are going wild with experimentation, like, you know, films that are based on literature, but also films that seem to be coming at film as if it were literature. I think even Milan Kundera said that the Czech film industry in the 60s was a connection to the great Czech literary traditions.
Well, I think the Czech movie too is like a testament to what Buñuel always said about how like there's creativity and restraints because you have this film industry where it's like, okay, you can make these movies, but like you can't directly criticize the government. You can't really get too ideological with the subject matter. So you kind of have to come at it sideways. So you have to kind of play with like fable and magic and like surreality, because you can't really be too like social realist, because that's when the trouble starts.
Ashley, maybe you will relate to this. When I watch Czechoslovak New Wave films, I think about my teenage years and my early 20s years, when you'd go to a raging and hilarious house party that was run by crazy art punks, where eventually it got shut down by the cops. That's how I feel about a lot of these movies. You've been to that party, Ashley. Maybe you even 100%. Threw the party. Where it's just going bonkers, the music's incredible, everyone's having a really fun time, and then at 2 a.m, the neighbors finally call the police on you.
That's true. There is like a really strong, like, I can't believe we're getting away with this energy to a lot of those movies. Where you watch it, you're like, how did this get made? How did they get funding for it? And it's like, it just feels like you're basically watching a very fast car like blazing down the highway, pieces falling off it as it goes.
But not like a sort of like kegger party where everybody's, where a bunch of jocks are puking on the lawn. It's more like every room has a different theater inside of it, you know, and the music's way too loud. And that's kind of what happened here with these filmmakers.
Oh, yeah. You know, there's bad acid in the punch bowl. The Knights of Oingo Boingo are playing in the living room. It's that kind of scene.
You know, in the 60s, Czechoslovakia experimented with this basic liberation of free expression. It was still a Soviet state, but, you know, they were coming out of the Stalinist era, and there was this feeling in the country that this is a place for us to finally stop being so repressed. Let's not have state censorship anymore. Let's show Czechoslovakia to the world. And they were extremely generous in terms of state funding. Like, that's one big difference between the Czechoslovak New Wave and the French New Wave, is that their cinema was nationalized. So the state was literally writing the checks for these things. And Prague became a very central artistic hub, especially for other people in other Soviet countries. The main school for the performing arts in Prague, called FAMU, was one of the oldest film schools in the world. The graduates include Miloš Forman, Ivan Passer, Vera Chichova, who directed Daisies, Yuri Menzel, and then other Eastern European filmmakers were also educated there, like Yugoslavia's Emir Kusturica and Poland's Agnieszka Holland, both of whom are still with us. But these filmmakers also had an agenda, sort of a hidden agenda, if you will, because they were all friends and the collaborators, and they, you know, showed each other their scripts and they all worked on each other's movies. Their objective was, quote, to make the Czech people collectively aware that they were participants in a system of oppression and incompetence which had brutalized them all. And many of these films are about that, even though you could argue that, no, this movie's not a critique of the Politburo and the older generation versus the young anarchic generation. This is a movie about a cat who wears magical sunglasses. What are you talking about?
Well, and also this kind of element too, of like using the master's tools to tear down his house, because like,
yes,
you have these like Soviet filmmakers like Podovkin who are teaching at the school, who are like teaching these advanced like Soviet montage techniques and like giving them like the best like cinematic knowledge that the Russians have developed. I mean, they're using those techniques as a form of social critique in response.
You and I watched a documentary about Yasny where they talked to Miloš Forman, and there was a very interesting little detail that Yasny is actually responsible for Miloš Forman's career as a filmmaker.
Oh, God. That is an absolutely crazy story. Because the story was like, you know, when Forman had to submit Black Peter, his first film, as a director to like an artistic commission, like everybody on the board except Vojta said no. And he basically pulled that 12 Angry Men. Like, he Henry Fonda'd the situation and basically argued so passionately to them to prove Black Peter that they basically caved and they signed off on it. And because of that, we ended up with, you know, Loves of a Blonde, Fireman's Ball, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Amadeus. I mean, that all happened because, you know, Forman was able to get through the door.
After the Prague Spring, Yasny went into exile for a long time, and then he eventually resurfaced in the United States. And there was a very funny tweet about a year ago from this guy who said that he had a teacher at film school, and the teacher told him that, you know, I directed a film about a magical cat who wore sunglasses and would show people their true natures. And then he said, and I watched the movie a couple of weeks ago and it was incredible. So Yasny was like a film teacher. I mean, he was a guy who felt very strongly about the importance of having a mentor. He had a mentor and he acted as a mentor for young filmmakers. But meanwhile, he's got like a stone cold masterpiece under his belt that nobody really knew about. The Cassandra.
That's crazy. Well, you know, and going back to that formula for a second, what's interesting too is that that also happened to Yasny with his the Desire, like his film that he made before Cassandra Cat, where like the review board looked at it and they're like, okay, we can't release this. This is too lyrical. Like, this is too idealistic. Where is like the materialist grounding? And it was like Mikhail Kalatovov, the guy who directed The Cranes Are Flying and I Am Cuba. He basically looked at it and says, oh, this is great. Like, send it to Cannes. And they said they got nominated for a Palme d'Or, and they're like, okay, and the rest is history.
Yes, in fact, Yasny is on a very short list of filmmakers that won more than one prize at the Cannes Film Festival. Like, it's a murderer's row of great filmmakers, and in there is this vaguely obscure guy, Yasny. But Czechoslovakian films were up for the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film 4 years in a row in the 60s. The Shop on Main Street and Closely Watched Trains won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language. Miloš Forman was nominated twice for Loves of a Blonde and The Fireman's Ball. And Yasny won the jury prize at the Cannes Festival in 1963 for The Cassandra Cat. I found out one of the guys on the jury was Ruben Mamoulian.
Oh, wow.
So, so he probably responded very strongly to this sort of Arthur Freed on acid qualities of the Cassandra Cat, because it really does feel like this sumptuous 50s musical, but it's batshit insane.
I remember in that documentary, they barely talk about Cassandra Cat, but there's that story where, you know, Yasny goes to Cannes and like Gina Kelly, like basically gave him a bear hug after seeing the movie. And it's like, it's exactly that kind of movie. Like it is basically an MGM musical, but without the actual, like, the songs. So you get the explosion of color, you get the dancing, you get that like this normal reality gets violently interrupted by this like higher like plane of color and movement. It's oh, God, what a picture.
So Yasny won two awards at Cannes. He won the Best Director award for another movie that we'll talk about later, 1969's All My Good Countrymen. He had already gone into exile at this point, but again, he had friends in the international film community.
Well, it's interesting, too, to think about how the Czech films did have that critical recognition for a time period, because like we were still in the Cold War at that point. So it's just interesting that, you know, these films from you know, communist country that were still able to have that kind of like social, cultural penetration in the West.
But they got a little nervous in the Soviet Union with Alexander Dubček was the current leader. And his big slogan was socialism with a human face. So it was supposed to be that you don't have to be in isolation to live under communism. There was freedom of movement. Like, for instance, the people that made films in Czechoslovakia were allowed to go internationally to promote the films, and they didn't try to defect. They wanted to present a positive portrayal of the country to the world. The world picked up on the coded critiques of the Soviet Union that were contained in these films. They also thought that maybe their popularity was because these films were anti-communist. And this was a problem that faced most of the performing arts in Czechoslovakia. And in 1968, the Warsaw Pact countries brutally suppressed the Czechoslovak government and installed new leadership and this new ideological program called normalization. Dozens of the films that were made in the liberated era were banned in Czechoslovakia until 1989, when Václav Havel took over and the Velvet Revolution occurred. So these masterpieces were unseen by the domestic audience for like 20 years plus.
That's wild.
And maybe that's why they strike such a chord in the modern age, is because they're so fresh.
Yeah, I mean, that's very, because I think it's hard-pressed to even think of really, I mean, I think maybe some Fellini films, I mean, I think kind of remind me of some of the Czech films I've seen, but like, it's hard to think of any international cinema that really is comparable in terms of what they're trying to go for at the time. Just that sense of freedom and play and experimentation. I'd say even the fact that they're not really beholden to like conventional narrative structure in the way that Western films are. Like, when you look at Cassandra Cat, for example, there isn't like really much of a character arc for any of the characters. There's not like that sense of like, here's a protagonist, here's a hero journey they're gonna undergo. It's more presented almost like as a grim fairy tale of like, it's like these kind of archetypes interacting. So I thought that's one thing about Chekhov that's really interesting is that it's not really rooted in like psychology or like, you know, that kind of more traditional storytelling. It's something else. With the Commander Cat, like one of the characters in it, Carol, the schoolmaster, which I'm sure we'll be talking about, was played by this actor named Jiří Sovák, who is physically a dead ringer for Anton Novotný, who was like the first secretary of the Communist Party in Czechoslovakia at the time. So like he's clearly a create cast and portraying the film as a parody of an actual politician. And it's funny because that guy, Novotný, actually liked Vote. Like he was actually kind of his patron. And so basically when he got a lot of the political blowback from making his movies, Novotný was the guy who kind of protected him and said, oh, leave him alone. He's just an artist. Up until he left office. I mean, at that point, Johnson's like, oh, I don't have my safety net anymore.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Cassandra Cat, a.k.a. When the Cat Comes, a.k.a. the cat who wore sunglasses, a.k.a. One Day, a Cat, and That Cat. It has many titles. This film was seen around the world, but, you know, it was so forgotten that you stumbled across it on Cinephobe, and now it has now been rediscovered. It played in 2021 in a restored version at Cannes. Everyone fell up and down all over it, and now it's like on the Criterion Channel, and it's like basically the thing they're promoting this month's programming with is the Cassandra Cat. How could you resist this picture of this beautiful Czech woman with a cat with New Wave sunglasses on his head?
Oh, it's such an iconic image. Oh, and also quick shout out to like Second Run, because they put out a Blu-ray of this last year. And the scholar Cerise Howard wrote a brilliant essay in that goes pretty deep in the history of the film. So if you have a multi-region player, strongly recommend you get it, because it's a brilliant disc.
It's such a silly movie that we don't have to get into like the weeds trying to describe it, but how would you try to explain the Cassandra Cat to a neophyte?
I mean, it's very much a fable where it's basically about a small town of where all the adults are kind of like hypocrites and liars and thieves. They're busy just trying to survive under this regime, but also are kind of cowardly and venial. And one day, a circus basically blows in the town with a magical cat where if you take off its sunglasses, anyone it looks at, it reveals their true colors. Which, as they explain in the film, it only comes, I think, in four colors, where it's like gray is for people who are thieves, yellow is for infidelity, purple is for liars, hypocrites, and careerists. And there's only one good color, which is red, which is for true love.
And if there's no color, it's because you're innocent.
Which is why most of the children are immune to its effects. But they do a big magic show, and at the climax of it, the cat is unleashed. The town, you know, stripped bare of their illusions, immediately goes batshit crazy. There's basically a dance riot, and the rest of the film is like the kids trying to find the cat and try to protect it from the adults who basically just want to kill the cat. And that's basically the gist of it takes like a half hour for the plot to get going. It's not really a story heavy film. It's much more just about this, you know, this magical atmosphere to kind of steep yourself in.
And it literally starts with the old man in the movie, who's sort of our sort of guide and narrator, saying "Once upon a time." And the movie also has the same actor also playing the ringleader of the circus. They're two different people, though, because I thought at first it was a fantasy. It was him seeing himself, but actually they're two different people.
It kind of almost felt like a different timeline because going back to the story, like that character, Jan Jelwerk, who plays Oliva, who's like the town's like keeper, basically, he's like a custodian. He basically goes to the kids and he's like doing he's being a subject for like a life drawing class. And the past time he tells him the story about how he was a sailor and he got shipwrecked, and he basically talked about how he met the circus and like how he fell in love with this woman, Diana, who had the magical sunglasses. So before we get introduced to like the circus, he basically tells us the plot of the film ahead of time. He basically tells us, here are the colors, here's how the cat works. But in his version of the story, the cat gets killed by the townspeople, go crazy after they're unveiled. And also, what I love too about the intro of the film is it kind of is a rear window opening where you start off with Jan Werick at the top of this tower, and you kind of see these very little opera glasses, and he kind of scopes out the town. And Vorstadt introduces you to each of the main characters, but also like the side characters who all become important later. Like, basically shows you who everybody in the town is, which is important because, you know, once you get to the big unveiling, like you get to see who these people really are.
The other thing that's going on too is that there's a kindly teacher who the kids all love, who is trying to introduce things that are beyond the curriculum, and he's always getting in trouble with the town's director. He's not named as the mayor, but he's mad at this guy because he just wants this guy to teach the curriculum and not to introduce flights of fancy and imagination into the children's lives. Very unsubtle.
He's very much like a modern tech bro, like a STEM guy, where he's like, imagination. Look, no, I just want facts. Teach the kids facts. And like the source of one of the sources of disagreements is that this mayor figure essentially, he's big into taxidermy. So like he basically shoots a stork in the town square, and Robert confronts him, goes, "Oh, you're a murderer," and you know they kind of come to ideological blows over it, because to this guy, he thinks like the best way to teach children is to, like, to kill these living things and to stuff them. And there's that scene in his office where he asks the janitor to bring in the dead stork and like, "Oh, fly it," and he has like the guy basically like run around in a circle around him, like holding up the stork. It looks like it's flying, but it's not.
The camera keeps cutting back and forth to the man spinning around the room and the camera spinning around the room, watching the people, watching the guy dancing with the stuffed stork. It's a very delirious moment.
Well, a really good piece of acting there too, because Vladimir Menzik, who plays like the janitor, it's very subtle, but he does this thing where, as he's running around with the stork, you can see him get excited and like lose himself in the moment. And you see him like look at his boss, and all of a sudden his face goes stone cold. Where he's like, "Oh crap!" Like he has to tamp himself down around his boss. So you see him like being jubilant like a kid, and then he sees his boss looking at him. Like you see his face kind of crumble. And he does that like several times as he's like circling and circling around them.
So there's this epic sequence where the circus arrives in town, and you just see the woman Diana in a black leotard with this cat with sunglasses on. The cat is incredible because most of the time the cat looks either mad or annoyed.
Oh yeah, that cat is definitely not having a good time in this film.
There's several scenes of like children running around holding the cat by its, you know, front arms. The cat is like, "Get me out of here." The cat is has the look like, "In 5 seconds, I'm going to tear your face off."
It's kind of wild with the cat is that in the original cut that Wojtek made, there was no close-ups of the cat, which is crazy because some of the most like iconic shots in the film is like those close-ups of it. Like it's really expressive eyes like scanning the room. And Jiří Trnka, the puppeteer, saw the cut, and he's like, where are the close-ups? Like, we need to see the cat's eyes. And the director's like, "Oh, yeah, we probably should do that, actually."
The night of the circus performance is incredible because they get together in this big gymnasium or something. And it starts off with this magician doing sort of a blacklight, like famous people players show, where some of the members of the audience feel implicated already.
He's basically stuck in the entire town. It's such a great sequence where it's like I love that the director doesn't even recognize he's being mocked till halfway through, and he's like, "Oh," and then he tries to play it off and like, "Well, who could understand this anyway?"
And then all of a sudden, we see Diana up on a trapeze swing, and then we also see a cat balancing itself walking backwards on a ball. And then we see that the ball is about 20 feet high in the air. And she takes the cat's glasses off, and then all of a sudden people change color. And you watch the Blu-ray. My main question is, how the fuck did they do that? Because it's an incredible visual sequence. I was trying to figure out that they were blue screened in, but the yellow people are yellow. The red people are red. The purple people are purple. And then there are normal colored people.
And the grays too.
And they're all interacting with one another and dancing around. And it felt like you can't do this without special effects.
Well, here's the wild thing. Apparently, because when I read up on it, there's no post-production on that part. Like it was all achieved, like it was through lighting, but also makeup. So like when you see people who are like the yellow and the red people, like they're slavered like in this stuff where basically, it's funny. They had to get a special dispensation from the government for it because they couldn't get makeup in Europe that could work for the scene. So basically, Wojtek had to go and go, hey, can I go to Max Factor and like buy a shit ton of makeup? Like, he just had to get signed off by the government to do that. But yeah, that scene, like when you look at that, you're like, how did they do it? It's like, well, that's a big part of it was like they would coat people like in like yellow and red makeup and then use lighting to kind of enhance the effect.
Yeah, that was my theory, was that they were doing spotlighting on with red light on people who were covered in red makeup. But the red makeup was so lathered on that all you could see that wasn't red were their eyeballs and their teeth.
They're like, practically glowing.
How did they do this?
I mean, it's a stunning scene. Like every time I see it, like it's like seeing any like Gene Kelly musical number. Like it's a stunning piece of choreography. But because of the fact there's no singing, it's just, you know, this very ecstatic music and these bright colors and these people who either look overjoyed to be red or they're terrified that they're the wrong color and they get into fights and they dance with each other. It's just this incredibly chaotic scene, but it's so beautifully rendered. Like I've never seen anything else like it in cinema. It's just an incredible sequence.
And it sets the entire town into panic. It looks like the end of a punk rock show at the end when the entire crowd is basically screaming and running out because they've been so humiliated. Immediately, people want to kill the cat who runs away. The teacher, as it turns out, is red when the cat takes the glasses off. And we realize that he's madly in love with Diana, the woman on the trapeze. Diana is played by Emilia Vassaryova. She was chosen for the part because of her gymnastic abilities. And she also said that it was very hard to film the scenes on the trapeze swing with the cat because they're in the close-ups, I guess they're on the ground, but in the long shots, she's like 20 feet above the stage. And the cats that they used were terrified of heights. So she got scratched a few times. We don't see any brutality against the cats, thank God. I was talking to you a little bit about one of the downsides of watching Hong Kong movies.
Oh God. Yeah. Like speaking of, this is a public service announcement. If you like cats, don't ever watch the film Dangerous Encounters of the First Kind by Choi Hark, because you will lose your shit what happens to cats in that movie.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Maniac, the horror movie?
No.
From the 30s? Maniac is the movie that brought us the bad guy laughing like that. But there is an unforgivable moment in the movie, listener discretion is advised, where the maniac in the movie squeezes a cat's head so hard that it's one of its eyes pops out.
Oh,
and geez. They used it in the movie. So horrible. Like, so horrible. I didn't know that going in. I just knew that there was this famous 30s horror movie. But like, that gives you an idea of the attitude that people had towards animal cruelty.
That's brutal. Especially in the last year, like it was kind of my Hong Kong year. Like I was really steeping myself in the cinema, and it's great. I mean, I love Hong Kong films, but that's always been the one thing with them is like they're very like unapologetic about like occasional animal cruelty, and that's a tough sit sometimes. But luckily, yeah, in this film though, there isn't any of that. There's the threat of violence, but yeah, you don't actually, you know, no cats are harmed on screen.
There's one moment where they're hunting for the cat and they see what looks like a stuffed cat on a hill and he shoots it. And then it turns out that it is actually a stuffed cat that somebody put it there.
Well, also there's a bit too, like where they're plotting like in like the teacher's office, like okay, we're gonna take the cat. We're going to kill the cat. We're going to get a robber. And you see like a cat skeleton behind them in the background. It's like,
yeah,
little nice little ominous touch there.
Well, you're kind of dreading it because the town's power figures want to capture the cat and they want to lie to the children and pretend that they just want to take the cat back to the circus when they're actually going to kill it so that it can't embarrass them any further.
Oh, I think it's worth pointing out with the director too, that part of his beef with the cat is that when the cat's unveiled, he's one of the few people who doesn't get tagged by the cat. Like he hides in a suit of armor so it can't reveal his true colors. Mm-hmm. And so any of the scenes where the adults are with the cat afterwards, like they basically, they hide when the cat shows up. Like they hide behind screens, like they dive on their tables. Like they're absolutely terrified of being revealed. Even like people who've already been outed, like they just don't want to get outed again. It's like his lackey keeps turning up as purple, but you see him every time he sees the cat, he runs anyway.
And there's a funny scene towards the end when the children find the cat and bring it back to protect it. And they're all walking through the town and we see a busy town square. And then all of a sudden they scream that the cat is back and all the adults run. And so within 30 seconds, the town square is empty and deserted. And then we see this children's crusade of about 20 little Czechoslovak kids with a cat leading the parade.
I love this bit, like the restaurant manager like dives under his car to hide from the cat. Yeah. And Oliva walked by like, hey, man, you good? It's like, I'm fine. I'm not hiding.
One strong visual moment in the movie is when we see the two lovers, the teacher and Diana, who's now wearing a red leotard with a red parasol, and they're walking around in a green forest, and then they get a ride on a hay wagon, and we see them on top of the hay wagon, and then suddenly there's an optical, which obviously represents them getting it on. And they cut to the old man from the movie who knows what's going on above him, but the movie doesn't spell it out, but it's very funny that that's so obvious.
This is just a fun random detail, but Jan Werick, who plays Comrade Oliva, at one point he was cast originally to be Ernest Stavros Blofeld in You Only Live Twice. He was the original casting, and like they actually got him on set. And they shot him like in the Stavros, like the suit and the cat in his arms. But what happened is the Bond producers took one look at him and they're like, we can't use this guy. Like, he looks like I had a quote here. Let's see, where was it? He looks like a poor, gentle Santa Claus. So they're like, yeah, they're like, he looks way too jolly. Get him out of here. What's also interesting about Jan Werick too is apparently he was like a very vocal anti-communist at the time. So him getting cast in the film actually was like eyebrow raising for Vojta. Like he had to really convince him to be in the movie. And afterwards, when the movie was wrapped and it played cons, the secret police basically came to Vojta saying, "We want you to inform on Werick. We also wanted to inform on Jiří Trnka." Like, basically named a dozen people who were involved in the film. And wow. The story goes that Jazzy refused, and he called Novotny, the first secretary, and says, "Look, if you make me inform on these people, I'll kill myself." So, to which Novotny calls the secret police and goes, "Hey, look, this guy, yeah, he's like an astrologer and a lunatic, but he's got the soul of a poet. Like, just let him make movies. Let the guy cook, basically."
Well, he certainly was cooking on the Cassandra Cat. It's a beautiful film. I was thinking, though, even though it's positioned sort of as a children's movie, there is not quite enough of the cat in the movie. I wish there'd been more cat.
That's the experience I had at first. Was like because it's so front-loaded with cat that once they come back from the hayride and they have that whole story where they're looking for the cat, the film does kind of lose like a little momentum. But it also kind of makes sense. Like it's like the hangover of a wild party, basically. It's kind of how mm-hmm. I look at that middle portion. But yeah, like it's weird as a kid's film, because to me it actually feels like very bittersweet. Like there's a certain sadness to it, I think, that I think we hard for kids to connect to. Like, especially the way it ends, where it has that kind of Orpheus ending, where it's like, mm-hmm. you know, Robert looks away from Diana for 1 minute and he loses her and like, he gets stuck in the town. Like, there's like this sadness to be like, oh yeah, like I had this wonderful magical time in my life and now it's gone and I'll probably never experience this again. Like, I had to live with the memory of it.
I thought it was very sad when they parted ways at the end. I was kind of hoping they would be together. And I also laughed every time the cat appeared on screen. Also, the cat, I don't know how they kept the cat's sunglasses on so well, because he's wearing glasses a lot while walking. If you've ever tried to put glasses on a cat, it generally doesn't last very long.
We just got to live in the mystery, Jesse. Like who knows? It's a miracle they're able to make it work. And also, too, like the kids' performers are actually pretty decent, too, where it's like, mm-hmm. like the film makes a cardinal sin of working with animals and children, the two things you never do as a director. Yeah. And those are like the two most important things in the movie. And it works.
Also, it's shot in this delirious CinemaScope, super widescreen. I like when people are using that frame, which is actually a frame that should be used for most musicals, to tell a kid's movie about a cat with sunglasses. Like, it's such an epic presentation choice.
Well, and it's great for a location too, because they shot like in Telk, which is a big Renaissance city, and it's this big, huge open town square. So having that like that wider frame really kind of gives you a really like good encompassing view of everything. It looks fantastic.
It's a beautiful film, also about turning one's imagination into art, which I think is a short way of describing so much of the film output of Czechoslovakia in the 60s. The film ends with the cat maybe gone, but he's everywhere in the town. Like, he's in a chalk drawing in the town square, and all the children are running around with paintings that they did of the cat in their school to show the teacher. It's just a gorgeous visual experience.
It's interesting too, because it is kind of like a collectivist narrative when you look at it in a certain way, because the film ends happily because the children unite. Like they basically gather around they basically work together as a group to save Robert and the cat from the mayor. And actually, there's this really telling quote is earlier when Carmen Oliva is telling his story about the shipwreck, and I only caught this viewing for the first time. And he talks about, we were on the ship. We all tried to stop it from being shipwrecked, everybody except for the captain, which I thought was a very telling inclusion, him being like, we all did our best to like save society, but except for the leader, like, fuck that guy, he sucks. Which basically is the film itself, because the school teacher, Carol, is responsible for pretty much everything that goes wrong in the town. Like, he's like this kind of malevolent, useless force.
Yes, and he is revealed at the end to have chameleonic powers, that he can change his colors. As he's run out of the town in shame. If you stare at him long enough, he changes from red to gray to purple. You know, like he's full of shit.
And one touch I love is that they gave him like the penguin haircut.
Yeah,
like that slick back Oswald Cobblepot hair, which makes him look so oily. It's such a nice touch.
That's a beautiful scene when his downfall happens, and there are all these jump cuts between him running around in different colors. I realize it must have taken a long time to film, because first they have to pour yellow paint all over him and then pour purple paint all over him, and they intercut all these different versions of him running. There's all this incredible editing going on in the film.
Oh yeah, and just all these poses. It almost like a Saul Bass intro. Like all these really exaggerated poses that he's striking, like these different colors. I mean, it must have been a nightmare to film that sequence, but it looks great.
We should talk a little bit about the filmmaker too, as we transition to talk about his other film that is also available on Criterion, which you told me about, 1969's All My Good Countrymen, because Yazny had a very tough life for making a movie that's so light and lively like The Cassandra Cat. So much pain in his life to lead up to that.
I mean, his father was in the Czech resistance, and like he was imprisoned and killed by the Nazis. I mean, he lost his first wife very young to breast cancer, after she gave birth to a stillborn child. And his brother, which is one of the most tragic parts of the documentary, he talked about how his brother was a philosophy teacher, and he got transferred to work with uranium. And his quote, which I found very chilling, was he said that the radiation split his bones apart. So like it's not even just the fact the man was exiled from his country most of his life. Like, he lost so much of his family in really brutal ways.
But he chose to continue working in film post the Prague Spring. And, I have a lot of respect for him as a film teacher. The film that was made about him was from one of his students who thought he was such a fantastic person who'd lived such an incredible life that he wanted to sort of basically document him. He died in the year 2019. He eventually moved back to what is now Czechia and died in Prague a few years ago, but he was all over the place. There's a minor Canadian connection with him too, because there's a brief interview with him and the Quebec film producer Roch Demers, one of his patrons who made sure that Czechoslovak films were seen in Canada in the 60s. But he went on to make some movies that many Canadians of my age know, He and Wojcik co-wrote the screenplay for a classic Canadian kids movie from the 80s that everybody knows in this country called The Peanut Butter Solution. I sent you the trailer. You were like, should I watch it? And I was like, you're not Canadian. I don't know if you'd appreciate it. But like, people go nuts for The Peanut Butter Solution in this country. It's about this kid who runs into some ghosts and gets so scared that all his hair falls out. Then the ghosts visit him again and tell him that he's got this illness called the fright. And they tell him that the solution is that he can put this potion on his head that includes peanut butter to get it to grow back. But then the kid overdoes it and his hair grows to like George Michael and beyond levels of size.
But see, this sounds like a Czech. This already sounds like a Czech New Wave film.
I know. It was that was a real penny drop moment. It's like, this sounds like the Cassandra Cat, the Canadian version. Anyway, everybody knows what the peanut butter solution is in this country. And this is the guy who directed the Cassandra Cat. So a little CanCon for my listeners. But let's talk about his super depressing final film from the Czechoslovak New Wave, which you told me about.
Oh, man.
1969's All My Good Countrymen. It was approved to be made, considering how harsh a portrayal of communist-era Czechoslovakia that it depicts. But he was in immediate shit for it. He went into exile because of it.
It's interesting because he got blowback for Desire from one of his older films, and he also got blowback for Cassandra Cat, which both of those films had very like subtle and like very like you had to really kind of dig for the critique. It was there, but like it was very subtle. There's a few Good Countrymen is not subtle. Like it is very explicitly like a very much like a cri de coeur against like it's against the government, against collectivism. Like it's very harsh, and like it's interesting because like having Cassandra Cat, which is a very joyous film. And by contrast, like, again, Oh My Good Countrymen is a great film, but it's a meat grinder. It's a film where you watch seven friends slowly get broken down, destroyed by the society they live in. And I think it's telling, too, that Cassandra Cat is full of kids and animals, which Wojtek loves, whereas All My Good Countrymen, there's, like, horses. There's, like, bird and animals, but that's it. Like, there's no pets. There's like two kids who show up at the beginning of the film, steal like a German gun they find in the woods, and immediately try to find somebody to kill. Yeah. which is such a perfect. It's such a perfect like. Okay, you know me from this other film. Now here's something totally different. It's like if Cassandra Cow's Born the Run. Like this is his Nebraska. Like this is like the bleak autumn. This is like the bleak autumnal. Like just. Everything's gone to shit film. It's an amazing movie, but yeah, it's not a good time.
And it was filmed in the small town of Kelch, which was Jasny's hometown, where also the Cassandra Cat was set. So,
and apparently the one of the main characters, Frantisek, the farmer, who's like depicted as I think one of the few people in this community who has real integrity, his story was based off somebody that Jasny knew, like that narrative of this guy who stands up to the co-op, gets arrested and loses everything. Like that was a guy he actually knew in real life. That story is based off like a real event. The people around it, though, I'm not quite sure about how much of that was based off of people he knew, but there's definitely some biographies drawing from there.
Yeah. And it chronicles, about a 15-year period with these seven friends who, some of them die, some of them are betrayed by the others. Some of them give up on their idealism. They all get older. And also in the documentary we watched, Jasny said that in his heart, he thinks of himself as a farmer and a person of the land. And this movie is very much in touch with that. There's a great deal of studies of people working the farmland.
There's also an interesting Cassandra connection because he reuses two of the actors, the janitor Menzik, is in the film playing a similar character. He plays kind of the town's kind of the incorrigible fief character in the town. Mm-hmm. And Brodsky, who plays Robert the teacher, it's really interesting. In this film, he gets cast as basically the school teacher role that he was fighting against the last film. Like he goes from mm-hmm. being the rebel to like being like the man in this movie. And there's even a detail in there I really like where he collects, he has a butterfly collection. So just like how Carol, the school teacher, had a taxidermy, like the kind of fascist character he plays in this movie, Brodsky, has his own collection of dead animals. So I don't know how much of a deliberate connection there is there, but I thought it was a really interesting contrast.
The other contrast I noticed was the Cassandra cat has this fun parade kind of feeling to it, like the children with the cat and the circus coming to town and the circus leaving town, all this pageantry. And we see several festivals going on in this movie, but they feel like folk horror as opposed to fun.
Like at the end, like they're in winter and they're driving and all of a sudden you have all these masked animal people come out of nowhere. It's like, it's not menacing. They're just partying, but like, it just the way they look and just the setting, it has this very eerie feel to it.
Yeah. I mean, because the whole film has been making you feel uneasy. So, I mean, it doesn't take much for you to get the chills from seeing the festivities in this movie. I want to also mention briefly, one of the Czechoslovakian films that it reminded me of a little bit was this film that I encourage you to watch called A Report on the Party and Guests from Jan Nemec. I'll read you the synopsis. While picnicking in the woods, a group of friends are interrupted by strangers who begin to forcibly interrogate them. Soon afterwards, the strangers take the group to a party. There's like this lavish dinner party in the middle of the forest. And it feels like this like evil Stalinist idea of like throwing a big party. It's even called A Report on the Party and Guests. It just sort of feels like everybody's under surveillance. What I love about some of the Czechoslovak new waves is that there's a bad vibe hanging around with some of the good times.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jasny also said that Dubček himself okayed All My Good Countrymen because he supported Jasny and he supported the arts and he thought that the country could handle a mild critique, and it wasn't all that mild. But
not even, yes, absolutely.
I just stopped myself there. He thought that it was okay to be able to critique the recent past in a movie, and it was okay with him. But you know, then he got tossed out, and there was no support anymore. And now he seemed like a traitor to the people that were in charge. There were a lot of filmmakers that were expected to repent, basically, and to apologize for what they did and to pledge their allegiance to the Soviet Union. And Jasny was one of the people who didn't want to do that. He said that it would have been a moral death for him to do that.
Yeah, I think maybe talked about that basically confronted him after All Our Good Countrymen, saying like, you need to go on TV and say this is your worst film. And at that point, Jasny's like, they gave him like 4 days to think it over. And he said those 4 days basically packing up and getting his family out of the country. He's like, I'm not going to do that.
He was not against socialism. He was not against communism. He was against totalitarianism.
And I also do think when you look at the film, when you look at All Good Countrymen, like it also is a collective story because a lot of the action rolls around the farmers like licking up behind Frontisek and being like, no, you know, we don't want to cave into this thing. Like it's a collective action that ultimately gets beaten down by a small minority.
He was a believer in the project, in the socialist project. I think he felt doubly betrayed because he was trying his hardest to take the state at their word that they were trying to create a more expressive and liberated and communicative culture after a long period of repression. I mean, that's the one thing that I look at the Czechoslovak New Wave as like, it's a cautionary tale about what happens if you put the hammer down too hard on your people and repress them so much. There's, if you suddenly let go of the reins, you'll get Valerie and her Week of Wonders.
Well, also too, like Wojciech, you look at his background, like what happened to his father, and the fact that he himself also fought the Nazis. Like he had a very strong anti-fascist streak. So, like when he saw those kinds of totalitarian tendencies taking root in his country, like of course he's gonna comment on it and he's gonna kick against it because like that's just very much at the core of his being. One thing that I wanted to note about it is like it's such a stark contrast in style, whereas like Cassandra Cat is this really beautiful, fabulous narrative. All my Good Countrymen is very grounded. It's very naturalistic. Like there is, I don't want to spoil it, but there is like one lurch into like the supernatural surreality in there, but it's very brief. But it's mostly just a very grounded, almost like neo-realist depiction of life in that country. So it's like the guy could do different stuff. Like he could shift modes. Like he wasn't just this whimsical, like magical poet. Like he could also like get real grimy with it. He seems like maybe a sweeter, gentler Herzog in some ways.
I said this on Twitter that like Costa Gavras made Z, a film about the Greek dictatorship, and he pissed off the Greek dictatorship by doing it. But Yasny made a film about a cat that wears sunglasses that pissed off the Soviet Union and sent him into exile. Like to me, that's the most important thing is get a reaction when you're trying to get, like throw a Molotov cocktail into the discourse. If you can do it with a cat with new wave sunglasses, more power to you.
Exactly. Like, look, buddy, we know you're pissing on our legs somehow. We don't know how you're doing it, yeah. But we know you're doing it.
Generally, a cat wearing sunglasses on a movie poster is bad news.
I don't know. I got to say, like, that's why I saw this film. That sold me right away.
Yeah.
As the sunglasses, I'm there. Ass in seat.
Let's wrap it up by talking about our favorite cat movies. This is a very spectacular lineup on the Criterion Channel. I just got a subscription, and I'm dazzled by the availability of all these incredible movies. A lot of the Czech films that we've talked about on this show are on Criterion Channel right now. Basically, you can't go wrong. Just hit play on one of them. But I love the fact that they've made this huge 20-film retrospective on the great cat cinema.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you have some favorites. I know maybe some of them are here and some of them aren't, but...
I mean, I know cats are very briefly in it, but I love Edward G. Elmer's The Black Cat. It's like my favorite Universal horror films. Because that scene where Bela Lugosi sees a cat for the first time and immediately freaks out and throws a knife at it. It's like one of the great what the fuck moments in cinema. The first time I watched it, I'm like, what just happened? And also the Tournai films like Cat People, The Leopard Man are just incredibly just atmospheric films. I could watch those over and over again.
One of the great cats of all time in a movie is the one in The Long Goodbye, which is here.
Yes. Oh, God, I love that. Just that opening bit, Philip Marlowe goes to buy the cat food, like in the middle of the morning, like 2 a.m. Like, it's so relatable.
The cat will tell you to go fuck yourself after you do this giant errand for it, too. Like, he goes to get Curry's cat food or something like that. He's obsessed with getting this particular brand of cat food for his cat, who immediately rejects it when he gets home.
Honestly, I give it to my low-key, my favorite Coen Brothers film, Inside Llewelyn Davis.
Yes. Wonderful cat in that.
Ah, oh, great cat.
That Darn Cat, if you've never seen it, is really good. It has an amazing performance by a Siamese cat who is like some of the greatest cat acting I've ever seen. The cat like opens doors and, you know, like fucks with everybody on the show. The cat's name is DC, which stands for Darn Cat.
I mentioned it earlier, but it's on the cat movie thing, Criterion. But that Lam Ne Choi, the cat film, is so it's the guy who did The Seventh Curse. It's this very crazy Hong Kong supernatural horror movie, but the cat in it is just there's a scene where the cat fights a dog in a junkyard, and the cat gives him a suplex like a pro wrestler. It's so bonkers. I love it.
I remember this cat movie from Hong Kong from 1987 called Evil Cat. I don't know if you've seen it.
Oh, no.
It's about a demon that takes the form of a cat. And it's got a lot of ridiculous optical effects and stuff. It's not on the cat movie series, sadly. One of my other favorite moments with a cat in a movie was from the 1999 film Go with Sarah Pauley. I sent you the link. I'll put this clip in the show description. But there's this kid who's like, I can't remember whether he's just stoned or on ecstasy, but he has this incredible nonverbal psychic moment with the house cat when they go to this drug dealer's house where they're just staring at each other and there are subtitles. And at one point the cat just looks at him and the subtitle says, "You are going to die."
I love the bit where he's correcting the spelling of Chiang Kai-shek.
Yeah. but it's so funny. It's not officially part of the Cat movie series, but you have to see, if you haven't already, La Talante by Jean Vigo. Have you seen?
Oh, yes. Yes, I love Jean Vigo.
That is an incredible cat movie because Michel Simon's little houseboat has about 14 cats on it. And they're just constantly climbing on him. There's some fantasy moments where you see, you know, close-ups of cats dissolving in and out. There's an incredible shot of like a record playing on a turntable with about 8 cats. It's an amazing cat movie. Another movie that I wish was on the cat movie series on Criterion is the Turkish documentary Kedi. Have you seen that?
No.
Oh, it's got to be around. It's a documentary about all the domestic and feral cats that live in Istanbul and focusing on about 7 of these cats. And you realize that Istanbul is stuffed with cats. When I went to Paris, I walked through Père Lachaise Cemetery and there were cats everywhere. And I found out that there's actually an operating budget at the cemetery to feed the cats.
Oh, interesting.
Actually, that's why they're all there.
Well, it makes me feel like, because I know like in Islamic cultures, like cats are held in very high regard. I've always been fascinated by that.
Yeah, I mean, some of the stories about these cats are funny and some of them are sad. But if you want to spend 75 minutes just hanging out with some amazing Turkish cats, I highly recommend Kedi. And also, you and I are big fans of Haozu.
Yes, Obayashi. Yes.
Yes. Incredible film. Kind of like an acid trip, like the Cassandra Cat. I think films that are like acid trips that involve cats, I highly recommend in general. But
there's also like a very there's a really weird, like almost childish, innocent quality to House too, where it's like a horror film, but it almost feels like watching like a Hanna-Barbera cartoon at times.
Yes, yeah.
Very strange. It's a really a unique vibe to that one. Well, Japan in general has a lot of interesting like cat horror films where it's like you have like Kureneko, Black Cat Mansion, where there's a whole like subgenre of like, oh yeah, cats, they'll steal your soul.
Another movie that's not included on the cat movie series that I love is a British-Canadian co-production called The Uncanny with an all-star cast, including Peter Cushing and Donald Pleasance. Cushing, it's like an anthology horror film, but the through line is that Peter Cushing is an author who is convinced that cats are an evil supernatural life form that is bound to destroy the human race. And I think he's not wrong. I think they are actually they are going to take us over.
Well, we were talking about this like off camera, like the idea of like cats and scale, where it's like, if a cat was big enough, it would eat us. If a cat was the size of Galactus, I have no doubt it would eat planet Earth. Like it'd just be like, oh, great. What a tasty little treat.
Or send it flying through space by batting it around and just running through space.
It's like how tectonic shift happens. We get like Pangea again because it just starts batting the continents around.
One thing that I love about cats in movies is that they're always the same no matter how old the movie is. Like you watch a film from the 30s and a cat is acting like all cats act now. So it always adds this sort of level of modernity to me when I'm watching a movie. It's like, hey, there's something contemporary, a cat ignoring somebody. I know what
there is. Yeah. There is a very much a timeless quality to them. Yeah. It's because they're lazy, they're passive, they're just kind of mysterious and unknowable, and they're just there. I think it's why cats are great in horror movies too, because it's like in a horror film, like a dog would save you, like a dog would like look out for you. A cat would probably just watch you die. A cat would just be like, oh, you know, hey, rest in peace to that human, but I'm built different, you know.
Now, have you seen the greatest cat movie of all time, which is A Talking Cat? With you Eric know, Roberts.
To my everlasting shame, I have not. I have not seen it.
I received it on DVD once because I was making so many jokes about A Talking Cat that somebody actually mailed the DVD to me. It's the movie where they use like MS Paint animation to do the cat's mouth when it's talking. And Eric Roberts is the voice of the cat, and he sounds like he was recorded in a public shower. Like it sounds like they had him for 20 minutes and he recorded all his lines into the phone. It's mind-boggling. It's David Descoteaux.
I have seen Roar, though, which the film where it's like, hey, let's get a bunch of actors and some real lions together. Like nothing could possibly go wrong here.
something like 75 injuries on the set of that.
Insane.
And shot by Jan de Bont, who filmed Die Hard. But he was he had like a huge gash that he got from a tiger while they were filming that.
I remember when the trailer for Restoration came out, like it was like trumpeting. That was like one of the selling points. It's like 75 injuries.
Well, it got you and I into the theater.
Not gonna lie, it totally worked.
Marketing works. The movie that makes me the most angry that I see trailers for these days is a cat movie called Argyle.
Ooh.
The Matthew Vaughn.
Awful. Dreadful.
I don't ever want to see that trailer ever again.
I think for the second we see Henry Cavill with his weird like Bart Simpson like pencil head haircut. At that point I'm like, I'm already off this train. And it just got worse and worse from there.
One thing that I love about the Cassandra cat is it probably costs like $350,000 today. Like it wasn't a fortune. Whereas something excessive like Argyle costs $200 million.
Oh yeah. And it does. And the thing, the worst part is that it costs that much money and you look at it and it's like, where'd the money go? It just looks like just a bunch of bad CGI.
Yeah. And the trailer was making me, I was like dying in my seat. Cause I was like, Catherine O'Hara, what are you doing mixed up in this? Get out of this movie.
Hey man, those Schitt Creek residuals only go so far.
That's true.
She's got to get paid.
Oh, you know, and another great cat in movies that we should mention before we go is Jonesy from Alien. We love him.
One of the all-timers. Rest in peace to a legend.
Did you know that the cat from The Long Goodbye is the cat that went on to play Morris in the Nine Lives ads?
Really? No, yeah. I did not know that.
Yeah, it was his screen debut.
A prolific cat. The Steve Buscemi cat actor is just out there grinding.
That's right. I mean, you know, once you get that Robert Altman part, the door's open. The cat door's open for you. Ashley, what have you been up to lately? Where can people find you on social media?
Well, mostly I'm still on the sinking ship that is Twitter. So you can find me at Ashley Naftool. If you live in Phoenix, I'll be producing a new play that I wrote called Selena and Julie Go Dancing in April.
Oh, wonderful.
So I'm looking forward to that. And yeah, just, you know, trying to keep my head above water in these semi-apocalyptic times.
And you also had a play last year too, didn't you?
Yeah. I did a play called Orange Skies. That's kind of like a small town end the world play. That actually went really well. We got good crowds. So yeah, I was very happy with it. Oh, I want to mention one thing. I also got something else coming out. Ethan Warren, who used to be an editor for Bright Wall Dark Room, has a magazine that's called Broad Sound that he produces now. And he's going to be printing a small play by me in their next issue, which is about Siskel and Ebert. So I had a lot of fun writing that piece, Roger and Gene. It's about their fight over Cindy Crawford. So I'm very excited about it.
When did they fight over Cindy Crawford? Around Fair Game?
Oh, it was before that. It was the story. I read this in a Matt Singer's Opposable Thumbs book.
Okay.
And the story goes is every time that Siskel and Ebert would fly together, they would get into a fight over the front row because apparently, scientifically, they determined that the third seat in the front row is objectively the best seat on an airplane. So they would fight like dogs every time they fly to get that seat. And I guess they'd start switching off. So that time, it was going to be Gene's turn to get that seat. But Roger's like, no, I want that seat. So they're in the airport screaming at each other. Grown men screaming about a seat for 15 minutes. Siskel like leaves off in a huff. And like a half hour before he board, he comes back. He goes, you know, Roger, I've been thinking, this is really immature of us. Like, you know what? You want the seat? Please, I want you to take the seat. Have the seat. And Ebert, like, Siskel has never conceded a thing in his life. But Ebert's like, oh, I'm touched, Gene. I feel really bad. Like, no, Roger, please, take the seat. So they go on the plane. Ebert's sitting in the front row. Like, you know, he's like the cat that caught the canary. Like, he's just overjoyed to be in the good seat. They're in the air, and he starts hearing, like, this, like, woman laughing behind him. And he hears Siskel's voice, like, talking. And he's like, Gene sleeps on planes. Why is he talking? So Ebert looks behind him, and in the seat that he's supposed to have, that the seat that Siskel gallantly offered to take up, he's sitting next to Cindy Crawford. It's like just flirting a stormer for the whole flight. And apparently that was like a sticking – for years they would argue about this after. Like he was so mad that he lost his chance to sit next to Cindy Crawford and Siskel.
My God, that's a pure virgin versus the Chad moment, isn't it?
Oh, it's so good. And the best part, too, is that Robert was, I think Ebert was single at the time and Siskel was married. So knowing how petty Siskel was, I think he just did that just to deny Ebert, just to be a jerk. Yeah, like you hear a synopsis, like that's like a sign, it's like a sitcom episode. Like everything about it, like just even right down to the fake apology, like that's classic like comedy writing, but it actually happened. Yes, I am writing about that incident because I can't stop thinking about it. It's just so funny to me.
Well, Ashley, thank you so much for joining me and getting me to learn more about Wojciech Jasny. He's really an undersung filmmaker. And The Cassandra Cat is essential viewing, I would say, especially if you love cats. Like, yeah, how could you love cats and not watch The Cassandra Cat?
And just as an FYI, folks want to see other Jasny films. I think Desire is on the Internet Archive, if you look for it there. And yeah, all Few Good Countrymen, I think it's still on the Criterion Channel. But if not, there also is a subtitled copy of it on YouTube. So just quick Google search to find that.
Beautiful. Well, Ashley Naftal, thank you so much for joining me. You are welcome back anytime.
Well, thank you, Jesse. I had a great time. Thank you for having me on.
Patrons of the podcast help to make Junk Filter possible. Over 30% of all of our episodes are available exclusively to patrons. To support this show directly and to become a patron, please go to patreon.com/junkfilter. And please follow us on Twitter at junkfilterpod. We'll have another episode in the next few days. The original music for this program was provided by Marker Starling. My name is Jesse Hawken, and thank you for listening.